Welcome. Glad you are with us tonight here on Wednesday night, March 15th, 2023. Going to be joined tonight by historian Bill Federer. We're going to talk about history and what's happening with America today. The death of the dollar, a nation going bankrupt, the fall of an empire, if you will, the American Empire. Maybe the comparisons between the fall of the American Empire and the Roman Empire. Are there some similarities? How about the dollar and what's happening with our dollar and Federal Reserve, national debt, hyperinflation? Get some historical perspective from historian Bill Federer. Then about 7:55, I'm going to be joined by Todd Bensman on what's happening at the border. A rush of people coming over the border. He'll give us a national security update. About 8:15, 8:20 Central Time, Trevor Loudon will join us. We're going to talk about China. The 700% increase of Chinese immigrants coming over the U.S. southern border. We'll also talk, interview I did the other night. I'll endeavor to play it now. Interview I did the other day with John Whitehead about what our government is doing to us, we the people. So busy night, let's get to it. Joining me now is historian Bill Federer. Bill, welcome back to the broadcast. Thank you for joining us.
Brandon, great to be with you.
You too, my friend. So we're watching this. We got to move fast because I know you've got another interview to do here soon. But we're watching the fall of the U.S. dollar, the fall of the American empire, I think probably a manufactured banking crisis to gobble up littler banks, to give over everything to bigger banks, which will fall right in line with the Great Reset. Are there, as a historian, are there any comparisons you can share with us tonight between the fall of the Roman Empire and the fall of the American Empire?
Yes. Matter of fact, I put together a book. It's called Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. And it talks about how you have to destroy the middle class in order to revert to a socialist dictatorship. Lenin did this, killing off the kulak farmers. Stalin did this. And you saw this regime change after World War One with the mark that Germans had to pay back reparations to other countries, and they decided to inflate their currency, and it ended up becoming worthless, but it makes all the savings evaporate, and that set the stage for Hitler to seize power, promising to fix it all. But as we go back in time, even the Bible said it was gold, silver, and copper. Exodus 25:3. It talks about, and the offering which you shall take of them is gold and silver and copper. Well, these were jewelry and different items. And so you would have a scale and you would put the gold on one side and then weights on the other side. And so there were weights called shekels or talents. And you would measure out and weigh the gold. But it really wasn't until the 6th century BC that King Croesus of Lydia, which is an area around Greece, he's the first one that took gold and actually made a coin of the weight. So it was not just a weight, it was a weight that was made out of the metal itself. And he stamped his image upon it. And King Croesus was so wealthy, that's where you get the stories of King Midas and everything he touched turned to gold. Well, the news of it spread to Persia, and they decided to attack and capture Lydia and kill King Croesus. And but then you have the Greeks. And their unit of coin was called a drachma, and it had a stamp of an image on it. And the Greeks had their island called Delphus, and it was Delos, that was where their treasure was. But Pericles moved it to Athens and borrowed from it to build his famous Acropolis and his navy and so forth. And basically was the first one to raid the treasury with promissory notes. I promised to pay it back, and of course, he never did. And now, an interesting thing about Pericles, the Athenians had a concept that if a leader got too powerful, 6,000 citizens could vote to ostracize him, and which meant he was kicked out of town for 10 years, destroying his career. And when Pericles moved the treasury to Athens and borrowed from it and was getting too powerful, rumor began to spread for a vote on whether or not to ostracize him. And so he decided to intentionally let relations with Sparta deteriorate so that a war would start on purpose. And people wanted a strong leader in time of war. And so this became a standard operating procedure. When leaders begin to get unpopular and there's no way they can fix their popularity, the next thing they do is get into a war, because everybody's focus is no longer on them. It's on the war, it's on people dying, and they get a pass. Sort of like, you know, remember Bill Clinton was going through impeachment and he fires some missiles into Bosnia and gets us in the, right? And so this is a tactic. There's a movie Dustin Hoffman put out called Wag the Dog, but that goes back to Pericles. Now we go in Athens to Alexander the Great's dad, Philip of Macedon, and he's the one around 357 BC that seizes the gold mines in Greece. This is sort of like he seizes Fort Knox. And now that he has the money, he uses money to bribe citizens of Athens to betray their city. Right? This is a foreign power using money to buy citizens in this democracy to betray their democracy. And like a fifth column. And it so confused Athens that Philip of Macedon was able to march up to the walls of Athens, and they were so disorganized that he took over. And the people of Athens did not get a chance to rule themselves again for over 2,000 years. And it wasn't until really after the World War II they got their independence, but now they got in debt again, and so they don't control their fate. Alexander the Great then has the largest empire in the world, and then it's conquered by the Romans. And the Romans have the largest empire in the world, and they had silver coins. But there was an emperor named Diocletian, and he he put on price controls to try to fix the economy. And Diocletian raised the taxes so much that people were simply leaving Rome and going to live with the barbarians. And so he made a rule that you could not leave your land unless the debt was paid off. And because of the inflation, nobody was ever able to pay off their debt. And this turned into the feudal system of the Middle Ages, where for 1,000 years, peasants were tied to the land. And that goes back to Diocletian. Anyway, so Diocletian is taxing and they have coins. Well, what does he do? He mixes lead in with the silver to debase the coinage. So it's his version of inflation. And then the Romans, the government would snip the edges off the coin, clippings. And so you'd see these coins with parts of them clipped off. And by the way, that actually came down to us when we used to have real silver coins. The edges around a quarter, those little ridges around the coin, why did they do that? Because people would clip off the edges of the silver. And you could tell if somebody clipped it off if it was done. Of course, now our coins are no longer having any intrinsic value. So Rome eventually craters, and then you have another development with money is Genghis Khan conquers all of the China and the middle Eurasia, and he has a grandson named Kublai Khan in the 13th century AD, and Kublai Khan invents paper currency. Right, Marco Polo in the 1200s goes over to China and is amazed that you can buy stuff with a piece of paper. And unfortunately, Kublai Khan printed too much of it and nobody wanted it. And this lent, and by the way, he called his paper currency the yuan. And that's where you get the Chinese yuan to this day. But he printed too much of it and that caused his empire to collapse. Then we look at when the Muslims were invading into Greece. All the Greek scholars and Greek money fled to Florence, and you had a banking house called the Medicis, and they became immensely wealthy. They were the George Soros and the Bill Gates and the Warren Buffetts of the day, and the Medicis married off their kids to all the monarchs of Europe, and so they were manipulating the politics all over Europe. And then you fast forward to the, so the idea was with a banking house like the Rothschilds in the 1700s, 1800s. You'd have a lot of rich people and they would have their money, but they would, the word would spread, hey, if you give your money to this guy, he can double it for you. And so everybody's like giving their money to the Rothschilds, Mayor Amschel Rothschild. And he was really smart at knowing how to invest, but he would only keep a portion of it in the banking house. And then the rest of it, he would lend out.
Is that where fractional reserve banking started?
Fractional reserve banking. So so that they would put their gold in there, and he would only keep a part of it, but he would lend the rest out, and people would pay interest on it, and he would keep the interest more or less. And of course, he'd give some back to the person who lent him the money in the first place. And then you would write bills of transactions, so the gold would never actually leave the house. It would just stay in the house, but it would go from one person's account to another person's account. And it worked fine until if too many people wanted to take their money out right away.
You have a run on the bank, right?
You'd have a run on the bank, right. And now the Rothschilds, because they were so good at investing money and knew how to do this, he had five sons. And he set up these sons in banking houses. So you have Amschel, Mayer Rothschild in Frankfurt, Solomon Rothschild in Vienna, Carl Rothschild in Naples, James Rothschild in Paris, and Nathan Meyer Rothschild in London. And the even Columbia Encyclopedia would say wars would be fought or not fought based on whether or not the Rothschilds thought it was profitable. So you'd have the king of a German kingdom go to the Rothschild, say, hey, I want to borrow money to fight France. And then his brother in France would say, okay, the king of France would come and say, hey, I want to borrow some money to fight the guy fight. And they would like size it up and they would say, okay, we'll lend you the money, but you have to pledge the assets of your country. And the biggest asset is the ability to tax the people. And so whether they won, they would get a part of the earnings paid back with the interest. But if they lost, they would gain the assets of the country. And so one of the famous stories, it's sort of one of those ones that's buried in history, but it's there, is the Napoleon is conquering in Europe. And the British send over the Duke of Wellington to fight him. It's called the Battle of Waterloo. And the battle has 100,000 men fighting. I mean, it's a huge battle. And it looks so Nathan Rothschild sends over a messenger to, you know, watch what's happening at the battle. And they find out that Napoleon is going to lose and the Duke of Wellington is going to win. Well, this is going to be great news for Britain. And so the word gets to Nathan Rothschild first. And so he sells everything he has really fast. And everybody else says, well, he must have got some inside information that the British lost. And so everybody starts dumping their stocks on the London Stock Exchange. Meanwhile, Rothschild has people buying up everything dirt cheap. Well, the next day, the official news comes that the Duke of Wellington won. And now the London Stock Exchange goes through the roof. And the story is that the Rothschilds made £1 million sterling in one day. And so it was this inside information. And so a maxim that's attributed to the House of Rothschild is, let us control the money of a nation and we care not who makes the laws. And so in America, you had Alexander Hamilton start a bank in New York and lend the money to pay our congressman. And then Alexander Hamilton helped start the Treasury. And then you have Aaron Burr, who starts a bank in New York City. And he's supposed to have a water company to bring water into Manhattan, but he ends up turning it into this bank and he ends up buying involved in politics. Alexander Hamilton and him don't get along and they have a duel and Aaron Burr shoots and kills Alexander Hamilton. And but you have the Bank of the United States that is started and the investors are mostly people from England. Here they are investing in this bank. And so James Madison cancels the charter of the Bank of the United States because it's a foreign-owned bank in America, and it has so much of the federal government's money in it that they can lend it out, make money off of our money. And so when James Madison cancels the charter shortly after, the War of 1812 starts. Wow, isn't that coincidental? And then you have them having the 20-year charter comes up again, and Andrew Jackson refuses to renew the charter. Andrew Jackson suffers an assassination attempt. The head of the Second Bank of the United States is Nicholas Biddle, and he boasts of having more power than the president. Nicholas Biddle would pay for the campaigns of congressmen and senators, and he owned newspapers, and he would write these editorials just slamming Andrew Jackson. But nevertheless, Andrew Jackson, his wife had died right when he had taken office because of all the negative campaigning, and he was like, didn't have anything to live for. So Andrew Jackson says this: some of the powers and privileges possessed by the Second Bank of the United States are unauthorized by the Constitution, subversive to the rights of the states, and dangerous to the liberties of our people. It is easy to conceive the great evils to our country and its institutions which might flow from such a concentration of power in the hands of a few men irresponsible to the people. Their power would be great wherever they might choose to exert it to influence elections or councils of the affairs of the nation. But if any private citizen or public functionary should interpose to curtail these powers or to prevent a renewal of its privileges, it cannot be doubted that he would be made to feel its influence. And Jackson goes on, controlling our currency, receiving our public monies, holding thousands of our citizens in dependence, it would be more formidable and dangerous than the naval and military power of the enemy.
You know, so that's his, and I don't know if that's part of his farewell address, but he talked a lot about this in his farewell address in 1837. And I spent like 4 or 5 days on radio in January going through his farewell address. And it's everything, a lot of what we're experiencing economically, the dangers of fractional reserve banking and so much. He warned about that in his farewell address in 1837 and said, if you ever get a central bank again, which I've done away with, if you ever do this again, this is what's going to happen. Well, we didn't listen. We got the Federal Reserve in 1913.
Yeah, and the Federal Reserve was put in place promising that there would never, ever be another run on the banks in America.
Well, look at that, folks.
And shortly thereafter, you had the run on the bank with the Great Depression. So it looks like instead of these runs being just sort of sporadic, now they could very well be intentional and benefiting a certain group of people. So it's quite a fascinating study. And again, that's some of the stuff I talk about in the book, Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. And the subtitle is How the Deep State Capitalizes on Crises to Consolidate Control.
And where do they get it?
AmericanMinute.com.
AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. I know I need to let you go, but being a historian, and history doesn't really repeat itself, but it does rhyme, as one person said. Being a historian like you are, what do you, I won't hold you to it, but if you had to guess and project a trend or two, what trends are you watching for the remainder of 2023? What do you think we're going to see? I think you already mentioned one of them tonight. When you have a financial crisis, you go to war. So do you think we're going to go to war this year? And if not, I mean, if so, okay. But what else do you see coming? If you had to guess, what do you see coming?
Right. So they need a global crisis in order to institute their global government. And I think they have global pandemic crisis, a global financial crisis, a global war crisis. But the World Economic Forum, their great reset is to orchestrate a global crisis that causes everybody to panic. And then the government will come and say, we got the CBDC, central bank digital currency. We can keep the economy going. Yes, we can track your money. We can turn it off anytime we want. And then the WHO, the World Economic Forum, oh, we want to be able to control everybody and quarantine people. They've been putting their pieces in place, and we've been like a psychological operation, just been mesmerized by distractions. And some people are beginning to see through it. It's going to be a question as to whether or not we can wake up fast enough. But thanks to you, I think people are.
Well, thanks to you. Again, it's a team effort. AmericanMinute.org, right?
.com.
AmericanMinute.com to get his book and all his books. He's written a lot of them. AmericanMinute.com. Thank you so much for joining us and giving us that history of the currency and banking.
Well, thank you. And there's more there, but I'll look forward to the next time being on.
Absolutely. I know you got to run and go be on another show. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Brandon.
Bill Federer checking in. Check out his site, AmericanMinute.com.